This is the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Flooding is our next topic. It happens. We know this. Yet we also watch as communities devastated by flooding watch the water recede, clean up the debris, and often build homes and other structures right back where the flood hit. Southern Oregon writer Tim Palmer gives us the history and natural history and suggests a different future in his latest book, Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. Tim Palmer is one of our more frequent guests because he knows and cares a lot about rivers and the environment and adventure travel and writes a lot of books about those and more. Tim lives in the Port Orford area. Tim Palmer, welcome back to the Exchange.
Hey, Jeffrey, it's great to be with you again.
Always good to have you. You give us a big start in the book, Hurricane Agnes of 1972. We were both living in the Northeast at the time. You were right in it, though. How destructive was it?
Oh, man, yes. I was ground zero of what at that time was the most damaging flood in American history. And I was in the little village of Camel in the Appalachian Mountains on a tributary to the west branch of the Susquehanna River. This tropical storm had moved across the south, causing kind of moderate damage. And then it went offshore, and everybody took a big sigh of relief, except it turned about and came inland again, renourished with a lot of new moisture off the Atlantic Ocean. And it stalled out basically over my house for 3 days. It rained and rained. It rained 15 inches.
Wow.
And the rivers came up and up and up. And the house I was in was almost flooded, not quite. I barely escaped. But other neighbors paid dearly for living on the floodplain. And I helped them in some recovery as soon as I could drive out, which was like 5 days, because there were landslides down, bridges out, floodwaters still raging. As soon as I could make it out, I returned to my job, which was as the environmental planner for Lycoming County. And there it was my duty not only to come up with some recovery schemes and deal with the catastrophe of the moment, but more important to figure out how to not have this kind of disaster happen again.
Did you find some deficiencies?
Really the seed that led to this book 50 years later.
Mm-hmm. Did you find some deficiencies in the thinking, though, that what the kinds of things you were supposed to do after the flood or that you thought should be done after the flood and what the regulations and general approaches were?
Oh yeah. I mean, deficiencies, yes. And there still are. You know, many of us live in a state of denial about floods. You know, we get hammered. People recover, you know, they tend to forget about the flood as they rebuild their house or do a new interior, or buy all new appliances, whatever. You know, we wait a few years, we get flooded again. And the problem, well, there are a lot of problems with that. That never worked very well as an MO. But today, and this is why I wrote the book when I did, the floods are going to get much worse. Because of the heating climate, the storms are going to be more intense, more frequent, more widespread. The floods are going to be greater and greater, and denial simply will no longer work as a response to this hazard.
Well, you know, you characterize the federal spending by Congress on flooding as suffer, spend, recover. Has there been much change in that in the last 200 years or so?
Well, no, not really. I mean, there have been a lot of attempts, and some of these approaches have worked to some degree. And in my book, I point to a lot of success stories, actually, where things, you know, really good progressive things are being done. But in the full scheme of our approach here, we still have a long, long way to go. I mean, historically, we depended on building dams in an effort to stop floods from occurring. Spent billions doing that. The floods still happen. The damages still go up almost every year. And now the floods are getting worse. We spent billions more building levees, trying to keep the floods away from our houses and businesses. That has not worked very well. I mean, it does. Both these work in small and medium floods, but not in the big ones. And the big ones are the ones that count. In 1993, for example, 1,000 of 1,500 major levees on the upper Mississippi River failed in that enormous flood. So these were the approaches. And ever since the 30s, there has been a movement to regard the way we develop land as an important factor in this formula. You know, we should not be building investments on the floodplain. And that gained some support, and with the Flood Insurance Act and then a reinforcement of that law in the 70s, more attention was paid to this. But still, here to me is a telling statistic. For every $1.70 that the federal government spends helping people relocate and move off of the floodplain and be done with the problem, we as taxpayers spend $100 helping people stay put and get flooded again. We do that through insurance subsidies, through disaster relief, through infrastructure rebuilding and whatnot. So the formula is still really reversed from the way it ought to be.
Tim Palmer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a writer from Port Orford. His latest book is Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You were talking about the thinking about floods are going to get worse. We have talked to a few scientists who talked about the atmosphere getting thirstier now and could potentially hold more water. Are meteorologists and hydrologists rethinking their designations of things like 500-year events and similar denominations?
Yes, they are, but not rapidly enough, not thoroughly enough. And FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which administers the National Flood Insurance Program, has been very late in the game on this one. You know, for many years, they did not recognize the increasing storms as a factor. Now they are beginning to do that. But we have a long way to go, and you see this in floods in cities across the country. Ellicott City, Maryland is a great example. In two years apart, and in the recent decade, they have had what were largely considered 1,000-year floods. You know, 2 years apart from each other. I mean, there's something wrong with the mapping and the calculations here. And the first difficulty is that the hydrologists, you know, doing the best they can, are working with data that does not go back very far. Sometimes only 50 years. Very frequently only 100 years, and we're talking about flood cycles that are thousands of years in duration. So this, you know, it's kind of a case of garbage in, garbage out when you have only that much data. And then we've not calculated in the intensifying storms of the changing climate, which are intensifying dramatically, nor have we factored in changes such as altered land use and clear cutting and strip mining and mountaintop removal and all these things that are a result of what we do to the landscape, paving it over, cutting the trees and so forth, that make the floods much worse. So all of these factors have given us a system here where the mapping, you know, is not nearly precautionary enough.
I see. So it's not just a matter of like, you know, this happens here, but it's also we don't take into account the human activities on those portions of the map that can lead downstream, which is
exactly.
Pretty much everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You list in the book a number of destructive floods. I want to talk about the most destructive flood in human terms, the Johnstown, Pennsylvania flood of 1889. It was certainly called an act of God at the time, but how extensive were the human contributions?
Well, it was entirely human caused. I mean, there was a big storm, and that might have caused a minor flood. But the damage there came from a dam that failed. It was a privately owned dam by a bunch of Pittsburgh industrialists. You know, this is 40 miles from Pittsburgh. It had not been maintained. There had been warnings issued. There were people that knew that the dam was built very shoddily and not maintained. And sure enough, it failed, and over 2,000 people were killed as a result. And, you know, the owners were never found liable for these losses. and it was the most damaging flood in most fatal flood in history. But many of our worst floods are a result of dam failures. And when you think about it, you know, a normal flood, it rains and rains and the water gradually comes up and then it quits raining and the flood peaks and it goes back down again. But with a dam failure, we're talking about the release of water that has been stored sometimes for years of accumulation, not coming as one storm, but coming all at once, you know, as many multiple storms, the equivalent of many multiple storms. So these invariably are our most damaging floods, and they come with very little warning. So that is another big problem that we have failed to adequately address. There are dam safety laws now, but the safety programs are very inadequately funded. You know, we funded mega billions and supported escalating costs of dams over and over again, but now the maintenance of those and dealing with the safety factors is extremely poorly funded in the economics of today.
Tim Palmer's our guest on The Exchange. His book is Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. You were talking about how the owners of the dam that failed in Johnstown in 1889 were not liable. And you also write about deadbeat dams in existence across the country now. Nobody's responsible for them?
For many of them, that is the case. I mean, our government safety officers in these regards, in many cases, cannot even find who the owners are. The dams have been abandoned sometimes many decades ago. And basically nobody is taking responsibility for many of these. So fortunately, a lot of these are small, you know, but there are large dams that pose significant safety risks. And again, this is an area that we've not funded well enough to even know where they all are, and let alone take the precautions and typically to do a dam removal when this is the case, you know, when it's an unsafe dam with irresponsible or non-existent owners. Many cases, I mean, almost all cases, these dams are serving no good purpose. They should be removed.
Well, we have had some close calls with major dams that are very much in the public eye and have responsible owners, like the Oroville Dam a few years ago. I mean, did that, for example, produce the kinds of changes in procedure that might prevent that from happening down the road?
Well, somewhat, but not nearly enough. Oroville is a great case. I mean, here's the tallest dam in America in a state that had the best safety program in the United States, administered by a major state agency. You know, the state of California was the owner of the dam. There had been warnings about the safety of the spillways at Oroville. The further analysis there showed that they thought they didn't really need to fix it. It would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars to do this. But bam, Oroville filled up, you know, and spilled over the spillway, and it caused extreme damage to one spillway. They switched it to another. That one became even worse. And this was a real nail-biter. I mean, 180,000 people were evacuated downstream. It would have flooded Sacramento if the Yolo Bypass were not in place to channel those floodwaters around the city if they had come. Fortunately, the dam held. You know, the rain stopped, the runoff peaked, and then it declined, and California proceeded to fix Oro Dam at a cost of many times what the original dam had cost to build.
So that the episode can't be repeated. That spillway that pretty much came apart, that's been fixed?
Well, they've tried. That is still an issue. I mean, it's still debated whether the result is safe enough today.
All right, I'll pick up the conversation on the other side of a break. Tim Palmer from Port Orford is our guest. We've talked to many times before about rivers and glaciers and adventures in the outdoors. His latest book is called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. We'll pick up the conversation when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in just a bit. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Tim Palmer, who's joined us many times with many books he's written over the years about outdoor adventures and the environment and a lot of water. Sometimes it's frozen, and his book about glaciers, and sometimes it's about rivers. His latest one is about rivers that get out of their banks. It's called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. And I get a sense, Tim, by the second chapter of the book, that rather like the complaint that our military is always fighting the last war, that we're generally preparing for the floods that have already happened.
Well, yes. And like I said before, the floods are getting worse. So we need to factor that into the formulas here. And, as I was also saying, we've counted on dams and levees and simply flood relief, paying people for to get back on their feet afterwards, where what we really need to be doing much more of are two things. One is effectively protecting open space that remains on floodplains, flood hazard areas that are not yet built up. And it turns out that that's about 90% of the floodplains in America are not heavily developed. So if we were to let them be developed, the problem could get to be nine times worse than it is. The second thing we really need to do is help people who want to move and get out of the flood zone to do that. And there are programs to aid people in relocation, but they're just simply not funded enough to make a clear difference in the outcomes that we're seeing here.
All right, let's set aside the human response for just a bit, because the book also, as I mentioned, offers natural history as well as human history. And so we'll take a step away from the human responses into the actual workings of floods in their ecosystems. They are actually quite helpful to rivers and valleys, aren't they?
Yeah, Jeffrey. There's a whole other side to this flooding coin, and I introduced that in Chapter 3 of my book. And that recognizes that floods have occurred since essentially the beginning of time, ever since the water cycle started. We all know this. Water evaporates over the oceans. It's blown across the land. It rains and flows back to sea. And sometimes it flows back in very large amounts. This has happened forever. And the natural systems on Earth have adapted to this so that most native fish actually need floods to have healthy habitat. It's floods that form the riffles and rapids that aerate the water and make it healthy, and that also scour out the deep pools, which are needed for cold water and for deep shelter from predators and high temperatures. So floods are needed because they carry silt and sand to the ocean, and it's that sand that creates ocean beaches. Without it, for example, when that sand is accumulated in dams upstream, the rivers don't carry that silt out. The ocean surf continues to erode the beaches, and so the beaches recede, and houses that are built along the water here on the coast of Oregon and certainly the coast of California begin to collapse and fall into the sea. So if you like beaches, you gotta like floods. Floods are what spill over the lowlands in the valleys and then percolate into the underground water tables. And as it turns out, we depend on that underground water for half of our municipal water supplies. So if you like having water come out of the spigot when you turn on the tap, you gotta like floods. They perform all these and other natural functions that are as old as time and essential to the natural workings of the earth.
And we stop those things from happening by hemming the rivers in, damming them, putting levees up, preventing floods.
That's right. Yeah. We create all kinds of deficiencies and complications in that natural system when we do that. But perhaps worst of all, in terms of, the human element of flooding here, we do all that, but we can't count on it solving the problem. The big floods still overtop the dams and levees and cause extreme disasters.
All right, so just philosophically, not like this could take out my driveway or car or house, just philosophically, and I'll limit this to the American people, are we ready to consider letting floods happen or at least happen more?
Well, I think so, Jeffrey. I mean, we're not doing enough of this, and that's why I wrote the book. But, you know, it's now very well known the way these systems function. When Hurricane Agnes occurred, you know, in 1972, I was a young land use planner at the time, so I'd been trained in some of this work. But it was a total eye-opener to me to go to a film premiere a year later in Washington, D.C., called The Flooding River. And that film, it was by a biologist called Lincoln Brower. When that film opened up, one of the first lines was that we have dangerously overregulated our rivers. And he proceeded to make the case of how floods were essential to the natural workings of the earth. That was kind of a new idea back then. I mean, I was blown away. I said, what did he say? Did I hear that right? And I think everybody else did too. You know, now it's no longer a new message. You know, there's been lots of biology, lots of science, lots of economics done on this, showing that, yes, in fact, we need floods to have healthy rivers and a healthy environment. So we've come a long way. We know now that the way we have been paying for damages is just not sustainable. It's billions every year. And, you know, ocean flooding is going to be even worse with rising sea level. So, you know, how much are taxpayers going to be willing to pay to bail the unfortunate flood victims out when we know that they're going to be flooded anyway? So, you know, I think we've come to which should be a turning point. And, you know, I wrote the book just hoping to push us a little bit over that hump into the realm of more solutions and less catastrophes. There are a lot of solutions now also that we can point to, of programs that have worked, that have been effective, that have solved the problem. These provide models for us to pursue and to emulate in other places.
I'm glad you mentioned ocean flooding and passing, because that is really not the topic of the book. We're talking about rivers in this book. The book is Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis by Tim Palmer, who lives in the Port Orford area. So before we get to the solutions, let's talk about what we tried so far. I mean, dams, for one. Flood control dams, like the ones on the Rogue River, have reduced floods, haven't they?
Well, they certainly have reduced or eliminated, as I mentioned before, the small and medium-sized floods. It remains to be seen what our Rogue River dams will do when the really big flood comes. We've not had a big one since 1964. And, of course, the dams were not in place then. I had a personal experience in this regard. I very nearly bought a cabin on the banks of the Rogue River about 25 years ago. And I met the realtor there, and I asked, you know, does this flood? And she assured me it did not, because they built a dam upstream, referring to Lost Creek Dam. It would never flood again. You know, that didn't quite pass my eyeball test. I run a lot of rivers. I'm familiar with rivers. It didn't, the negotiation didn't quite pass my sniff test. So I went right to the county planning office, and sure enough, I was squarely in the floodplain, just waiting for an atmospheric river with my name on it. So, of course, I did not buy that lot, but I'm sure somebody else did, and they probably had no idea that it would flood again. There's no disclosure requirement in this regard across most of the country. So, you know, we just have a long way to go in the precautions that we take here and in choosing where to build and where to live.
Yeah, and those decisions are certainly influenced, as you're pointing out, by the presence of flood control dams nearby. Obviously, we're talking about dam removal more frequently now than dam construction. Generally, not with flood control dams, I find. But let's talk about levees too, that hem the rivers in and allow people to build areas outside the levees on what is dry land when the levees are built. Are we falling out of love with them too, Tim?
Well, I certainly did. You know, I mean, to me, 1993, I was working as a planner. Then that big Mississippi flood kind of raised the big red flag for me when 1,000 of 1,500 major levees, let alone hundreds of smaller ones, failed because the flood was big enough to overtop or undermine even big levies of the Army Corps of Engineers. Sacramento had a totally close call. I was living in Sacramento in the floodplain about 30 feet below the top of the levee in a beautiful little neighborhood during the flood of 1986. And I walked up to the top of that levee, and here there was this Pacific Ocean of water roaring by about 2 feet below the top of the levee on one side. And I looked on the other side across this roofscape of hundreds of houses in Sacramento. The people, even the officials in charge, had no idea at the time how seriously that levee was compromised and the degree of jeopardy that the whole city was in at that point. The chief floodplain official there today said, quite frankly, they should have evacuated Sacramento.
Well, and that, didn't.
I got to finish this. Sure. With respect to the people who became in charge, Sacramento has since spent about $4 billion spent and programmed for spending now, upgrading those levees, changing the management of the dams upstream to try to avoid that kind of close call again. But, you know, Sacramento can afford to do that. Most places in America cannot. And another 90% figure, 90% of the levees are in areas that do not have that kind of population density and economic wherewithal to actually deal with their own problems here. So they're going to flood again.
They are. And so when we begin to talk about, okay, how can we alleviate this? If we can't fix the river, we can change where we are in relation to it. And I do notice, Tim, the idea of pulling back from rivers and letting them act more like rivers comes with a negative connotation. The term used is retreat. Is that a bit of a barrier to action in itself?
Well, you know, retreat's a great idea when you're facing annihilation, you know. But yes, I mean, it needs to be a multi-pronged approach. For one thing, we should not be building more in those hazard areas. We should be helping people move when they can. We should be widening the space that the river has to flow between levees by moving the levees back where that's possible. That, too, is extremely expensive because once you build the levee, people build new houses where they think they're protected, but in fact are not. So it's very expensive to move the levees back, and often I think it's probably cheaper to actually get rid of the levee and buy out the area that's prone to flooding. But that, you know, is too often a very unpopular approach to take. So we keep kind of putting Band-Aids on the problem, fixing up levees and doing what we can. But, you know, the big day of reckoning is still to come here because we're going to see larger floods.
So we have about a minute left to cover that part of it. I mean, the fact is, given what our infrastructure is, given what is going on with climate change in the atmosphere, we can't do this fast enough, it seems, can we?
Right. You know, Jeffrey, I think the ultimate truth here is that we tend to regard the laws of nature as optional when in fact they are absolute. And meanwhile, we regard our own habits and laws and practices as absolute when in fact we can change them whenever we have the collective will to do so. In our minds, we have perfectly reversed the way the world actually works. And nowhere is this predicament and its consequences as clear as in the floods that are growing greater with nearly every year.
All right. It's a really fascinating history, both human and natural, and the remedies we've come up with, though they may perhaps be inadequate in the near term, they're interesting to read about as well. The book is called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis, the work of Tim Palmer from the Port Orford area. Tim, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's good to be with you.
And that's it for today's Exchange. Find this and all of our interviews archived on the web at jeffexchange.org. For senior producer Angela Decker and all of us at JPR News, thank you for listening. Join us again soon on The Exchange, and have a great day.